Or turn back, if you would, to the book of Esther, to Esther chapter 8 and 9 that we were just reading. And we've been looking over the last few weeks at the drama of Esther, And in this book we've met this King Ahasuerus, this emperor of Persia. And he's an over-the-top character, rather cowardly, easily manipulated, quite fickle emperor. And he rules over a vast, splendid, eye-watering empire that we saw in the first chapter. It covers most of the known world. Even in this chapter, we're reminded it stretches from India to Ethiopia across 127 provinces. And we saw in chapter 1 the greed and pretentiousness and the immorality of that nation. And we met these two characters, Esther and Mordecai. And they make a series of disappointing compromises and some rather dubious decisions as they go along their way. And the situation just descends through the book of Esther and leads us perhaps to despair as this evil mastermind, Haman, the enemy of the Jews, unleashes his plot. And it's rubber stamped, of course, by the fickle King Ahasuerus. And he launches this plan to eliminate all the Jews living in the empire. All of those living in Shushan, the capital, and right around the empire too. Even those Jews who are back in Jerusalem at this time, rebuilding the city there. All of them are under this threat. All of them stand on the brink of destruction. And with it, God's people, God's promises, God's plans, all those things that he's set. And finally, Esther and Mordecai make a stand. And they rise to become our heroes, willing to risk everything to save the day. But the turning point in the story comes without any help from them. In the sleepless night of King Ahasuerus, he summons one of his servants. He asks them to read from the annals of the king to put him to sleep. And one of them just happens to read a passage in it about Mordecai. And there in that sleepless night of Ahasuerus, the king is reminded of Mordecai. The next day there's this comical sketch as Mordecai is honoured and Haman is the lapdog who has to do it. And Haman's evil plans begin to unravel. And then Esther proves that she's more than a pretty face. And after solemn fasting and preparation, she faces the king and gently wins him over, pleading for her life and her people's. And almost before Haman realizes it, he's unmasked as the perpetrator of a death threat against the queen. Ahasuerus, of course, is made to look a fool. But rather conveniently for him, Haman's pleading for his life can be suitably misinterpreted to look like an assault on Queen Esther. And Haman is strung 20 foot up on his own gallows. In the words of Churchill, this isn't the end. It's not even the beginning of the end. But perhaps it is the end of the beginning. I think that's what we see here in the book of Esther, as the book of Esther seems to come to an end, but yet it is just the beginning of the end. And in it is something of a continual story, as we'll look in a moment. For Esther and Mordecai, they're safe. They're honoured. Beginning of chapter 8, that very day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. This rich man who was boasting before of his wealth back in some of the previous chapters. Now it all belongs to Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he'd taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. For Esther and Mordecai, you might get to that verse and think, well, they all live happily ever after, don't they? Esther is given the vast wealth of Haman. And Mordecai is made prime minister in place of Haman. For them, it ends here at this moment in beginning of chapter 8, and they've risen to such prominence. Mordecai has gone from being some servant at the king's gate to now being the prime minister. Chapter 8 and verse 15 tells us that he went out of the king's presence, dressed in blue and white, with a great crown of gold and gilt garments of fine linen and purple. It was the same language they used at the king's banquet back in chapter 1. Now Mordecai is dressed in the splendour of king-like status. And there he is. It's a funny point, of course, in the book of Esther. And some people would look at a story like this and say, well, look, Esther made her mistakes, but it all turned out all right in the end. So it doesn't matter too much, does it? And I've heard people use the book of Esther to justify doing things that aren't right. And people say, well, look here, Esther did some things that she shouldn't have, but it all turned out all right on the night, so we don't need to be too worried about it. There may be things that we know as Christians aren't right, but we can sometimes do them anyway, and it'll all turn out all right. God will work it out for good. And in this instance, it is partly true. God does even use their disobedience for good. Esther gets herself in this place by making a series of compromises, by living for 5 years completely without any noticeable mention of doing anything as one of God's people. She's a Jew, but she lives for 5 years. She can't give that away. So in the course of 5 years, she must have broken every law of Moses. To give nothing away, to out her as a Jew, there in the royal courts. And yes, here it does turn out for good. God uses her disobedience and the situation that her and Mordecai ended up in, and he uses it for good. But the Bible never gives us the grounds to do it anyway. And rather, actually, I think the book of Esther may point to the opposite. Here in these verses, at the beginning of chapter 8, Esther says to the king, I'm a Jew. Here's my adopted dad, Mordecai. He's a Jew too. He's a good guy. You can trust him. And the king promotes him as prime minister. The king accepts her words as she tells all and reveals that she's a Jew. He accepts that. He just seems not to have a problem with that. He even promotes Mordecai in that. And perhaps that beckons the question, what if Esther had done that 5 years before? What if 5 years before, when Esther had become queen, she'd just said that all along? I'm a Jew. I worship the God of Israel. This is my adopted dad, by the way. He's a Jew too. He's a trustworthy guy. Who knows what would have panned out 5 years before? We don't know. The Bible never tells us the answer to our what-if musings of our imaginations. But there is a bit of an implication here, I think, isn't there? Although God can use our disobedience for good, he never excuses or encourages us to be disobedient. And if Esther and Mordecai had obeyed God and followed him, maybe they would have ended up in a very similar place, but spared themselves 101 troubles along the way. Because it is clear from the Bible that obeying God is always the best option. It may not be the easiest option, but it's undoubtedly the best option. And yet, here in our story, Esther and Mordecai have been promoted. They're now wealthy, they're now powerful. In many ways, they're above any danger now. But the decree still stands. The Jews are still under threat. The king passed a law that on a certain day, the 13th day of the 12th month, people across the empire were allowed, not just allowed, but rather encouraged and commanded to kill all the Jews in the empire. And the law still stands. in all likelihood, no one's going to actually come with a sword after Esther or Mordecai, are they? They're far too powerful now. They're pretty much invincible. But everyone else? Everyone else is still in danger. And the story moves to sort of build up a little bit of that tension in that. What about everyone else? And here is what Esther says, verse 3, chapter 8. Now Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, and implored him with tears to counteract the evil of Haman the Agagite, the scheme which he devised against the Jews. And the king held out his golden scepter towards Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king, and said, if it pleases the king, and I found favour in his sight, and the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hamathatha the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who were in all the king's provinces. How can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? How can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen? Esther's changed. Remember the first time that Mordecai told Esther about this threat? She said, oh, well, what can I do? But in the end, she was persuaded, she was moved to risk her life in going to the king. And here again, she comes back to the king. She comes back to the king and with tears. She talks about the great anguish that there would be on her heart. How could she endure to see such destruction happening? She comes and pleads for the king to do something about this situation. And Esther asked the king, verse 3, to do something to counteract the evil that has been done. And yet, what can be done? The king tells us in chapter 8, he's talking about his laws. And end of verse 8, he says, whatever's written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke. And they use the same language back in chapter 3, when Haman wrote his laws. The king's law cannot be revoked. Haman's law was the king's law. This decree, ordering the massacre of the Jews, it was written in the king's hand, sealed with the king's signet ring. It could not be revoked. And so when Esther asks, what can you do to counteract this evil? The easy answer is nothing. I can't do anything. She asks, verse 5, can you revoke the letters of Haman? Easy answer, no. That's what he says in verse 8. What's written in the king's hand and sealed with the king's signet ring cannot be revoked. We, of course, know what's going to happen next. But if you're sort of thinking it of the Israelites, of the Jews living in this situation, if you're thinking it from Esther's point of view and Mordecai's point of view, no one actually knows the answer. We too easily leap in with it. But there's quite a lot of tension here in the story. It's a little bit like a murder mystery with Poirot or Inspector Morse or something like that. And you've watched this programme and it's just a web of lies and intrigue and evil and manipulation. And then you're waiting for that last scene when Inspector Morse just unpicks it all. And very neatly just says, oh, well, that's that case, and then that means this, and this obviously points here, and there you go. There's the murder sorted out. There's the culprits. And it's a little bit like that here in the Book of Esther, in this drama. It's sort of building up this web of problems, of this evil, this manipulation, these half-truths, these laws that can't be changed. And we don't really know how anyone's going to sort this out. What do you do with an irrevocable law that commands the massacre of the Jews? What do? When you can't change the law? It's a problem of their own making. It's a problem that they love to talk about. You'll find it in the same in the book of Daniel. The Medes and the Persians love this little phrase. These laws that will never change. We never change our laws. Which, of course, is the prime reason of stupidity and arrogance, isn't it? To say we never need to change something. But there they go. They've made this law. And a problem of their own making. How are they going to get out of it? Here in the book of Esther, there's this nail-biting tension. Esther and Mordecai are safe, but none of the rest of the Jews are. We're up a creek without a paddle. What's going to happen next? And the king seems to recognise this. Esther pleads before the king, and the king says in verse 7, I've given you the house of Haman. Like, duh, what else can I do? I've given you loads of money. Surely that's going to sort this out. I've even hung Haman on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. A little bit of a half-truth. It was because he laid his hand on Esther. But anyway, I've done all I can. We've strung him up 20 foot in the air. My hands are tied. Can't change the law now, can I? And so he palms them off, verse 8. You yourselves write a decree concerning the Jews, as you please, in the king's name. Seal it with the king's signet ring. And whatever you write in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke. So the king's suggestion is this. Well, I can't do anything about this previous law. It's irrevocable. But I tell you what, you can write another one. And actually, tell you what, you just do it. Don't tell me a thing. You'd have thought Daft King Ahasuerus would have learned from that. He got into this mess because he allowed Haman to write a law without him knowing. And now he just says to somebody else, you're going to write another law too. Now, don't bother me with the details. Just get on with it. You sort it out yourselves. Because the king's got no idea how to solve this, has he? So what are they going to do? What do you do with an irrevocable law? And then you have this little build-up of bureaucracy. Verse 9, the king's scribes were called in, and on the third month, the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day, and it was written, according to order Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, the princes of the provinces, from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces in all, to every province in its script, to every people in their language, to the Jews in their script and language. He wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by couriers on horseback, riding on royal horses, bred from swift steeds. All very similar to chapter 3, sort of echoes of what Haman was doing when he passed the first law. Here's this build-up of bureaucracy. Here's the big wheels of the civil service beginning to roll ever so slowly. And here we are. Not that anyone's told us what's happening yet. There's also an intriguing time delay in the story as well. We're told in verse 9, this happens in the 23rd day of the third month. And yet, back in the previous chapter, we're told that Esther went to see the king when it was only the first month of the year. When Haman passed the law, it seems everything moves very fast. Haman passes this law. There's a couple of days of fasting. Esther goes to the king. There's one banquet. The day later, there's another banquet, and Haman's hung. It all happens ever so fast. And now 60 days has gone past. There's this time delay. This nail-biting tension. What are we going to do in this situation? Well, what do? You pass another irrevocable law. If you've got one law that says the Jews could be massacred, the only way to get round it is to pass another law to say they can defend themselves then. And it is that sort of moment when they write this and when it's just given to us. And you think, oh, of course. That's the obvious answer. We all knew that was going to happen, but we've read the story before. But in the story, they've no idea of that, have they? Here it is. They can gather together, verse 11. By these letters, the kings permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives. So obvious, really. Why didn't we see that coming? There it is, the answer to the story. They can gather together and protect themselves. He carries on with the same language, and lots of it echoes the original law of Mordecai. They can protect their lives, verse 11. To destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them. That's the same language they used in chapter 3, that they were going to kill, destroy, and annihilate the Jews. Now the tables are turned. They're allowed to defend themselves, and they can do those things to others, any who would assault them. They're told to get ready. So this happens in the third month. There's still another 9 months to go. But they can get ready. They can make preparations for that, for it to happen. Verse 13. So a copy of the document was issued as a decree in every province and published for all people so the Jews could be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. And the word avenge is quite an important one. It is talking about justice. It's a word they would use for justice. So they weren't just allowed to go on a rampage, the Jews, and just destroy anyone and anything they liked on this day. It had to be in a just setting. They were defending themselves, avenging themselves on those who are seeking to destroy them. And so it all sort of parallels what happens in chapter 3. And then in chapter 9, it all happens. In chapter 9, you have this climactic battle. The day comes. Verse 1 of chapter 9. Now, the 12th month, that's the month of Adar, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. That's both of them, by the way. On that day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, and the opposite happened. There's this climactic battle. They can gather together, defend and protect themselves, and the calendar just flicks past to this day in the end. And on this day, the Jews have all done that. They've prepared themselves, they've got ready, gathered together to defend themselves. They've circled the wagons. Protecting their women, their wives, their children. We're told in verse 3 that they're helped by others. Chapter 9, verse 3, all the officials of the provinces, the satraps, governors, and all those doing the king's work helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai was on them. So lots of people, it seems, come to their help. Maybe these officials and satraps, maybe they lent soldiers, lent them weapons and things like that. Maybe they said they could protect themselves in their castle or whatever it was. There were those who helped them in those things. And yet, it's a pretty brutal passage, isn't it? It's a little bit like, in this drama of Esther, it's a little bit like a war film. It's grim and gritty. It's bloody and brutal. A little bit like we're going to fight them on the beaches, we'll fight them on the landing fields. It's a little bit like that here. There's this fight for survival. Verse 1, there were those enemies, the enemies of the Jews still. And they hoped to overpower them. And yet the opposite happens. But that's their desire, that's what drives them there. Even on this day, now there's been these two laws passed. There are still these enemies who get up that morning saying, right, this is it. We're going to kill the Jews. We're going to wipe them out. They're still driven with a hatred. This desire to overpower them. It tells us in verse 2, they sought their harm. They wanted to harm. They wanted to hurt. That's why they came. It tells us in verse 1 and again in verse 5 that they did with that with those who hated them. Driven by this reckless hate. Even though the king's now passed another law. Even though they were hoping with this reckless, passionate hatred to wipe out the Jews. Even though the king then passed this other law that the Jews could defend themselves, they still go for it. They're still driven. Even after Haman's plan was ruined, even though this second law had been passed, they still rise up against the Jews. It tells us in verse 10 that it seems to be rather led by the 10 sons of Haman. Gives us their unpronounceable names in the verses before. Tells in verse 12 that in Shushan, the capital, 500 men were killed. 500 of these enemies gathered there against the Jews, perhaps led by these 10 sons of Haman. Tells us in the empire in verse 16 that 75,000 were killed. It's a pretty ghastly scale, isn't it? And we're unused to that sort of thing, aren't we, in our modern-day Britain and the like? And these things sort of shock us and sound so brutal and so harsh to hear about these things. We might wish there must have been an easier way to sort this all out. But here it is, this bloody, this brutal battle that takes place. It's reminding us several times through the verses, though, they didn't take any plunder. Even though they were allowed to, in Haman's law. And of course, in Mordecai's law, it did mention they were allowed to take plunder from their enemies. Because, of course, in Haman's law before that, the whole purpose of it had been to kill the Jews and plunder all of their things. But several times in chapter 9, we're told they didn't. They didn't plunder. What was going on here was a fight for survival. There were these fanatics who would stop at nothing. These 10 sons of Haman, seems the sort of mastermind. Perhaps they've been in cahoots with their dad the whole time with this scheme to kill the Jews. And maybe even after their dad is killed and hung up, they're the ones who are still spearheading the same scheme. They were hoping for victory, verse 1. They were hoping at the complete annihilation of the Jews. And the opposite happens. They're overpowered. And yet the story seems to be one of this brutal fighting. It almost sounds like this sort of street fighting that's going on. Sort of imagine the Jews sort of camped out in the town squares as there's these raging mobs coming through the city towards them. Verse 2, the Jews gathered together in the cities through all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could withstand them because fear of them fell upon all the people. Verse 5, so the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and they did what they pleased with those who hated them. It's a brutal, brutal scene, isn't it, in this drama that leads in the end to victory. Perhaps it's one of those chapters we find a little bit uneasy with. It's a difficult chapter to sort of read and understand, and it seems so far away from our times, doesn't it? And that can sometimes, rather unhelpfully, give us a little bit of a sort of moral superiority. As often that, in our day and age, all we read these things of the primitive people who lived far away and a long time ago and how ghastly and cruel they were, but we would never do a thing like that. Often it breeds a sort of smug superiority to it. And yet we see here this brutal fight that was going on. And yet all the same, we might be a little bit uneasy, even as Christians reading this, and hear these things that the Jews do. And yet it seems light years away from Jesus' words to forgive those who persecute you and pray for those. So what are they doing here? They're not praying for their persecutors, are they? They're cutting them down with the sword. And perhaps we sort of feel a little bit of that tension in that, and a little bit of an unease with this sort of part and parts like it of the Bible. But what it does remind us of is the reality of a cosmic war. The reality of a cosmic war. Several times in the passage it reminded us of something we'd noticed before, Haman the Agagite. Haman the Agagite. And that, for the Jews reading this, once they realised that, brought back these memories of their history and things like that. Because the Agagites descended from the Amalekites. They were sort of a kingly bunch amongst them of the Amalekites, who were these enemies of Israel. And so this picks up one little battle scene, as it were, with its drama and so on. But it's part of something much bigger. When the Israelites left Egypt, as they were journeying through the desert, the Amalekites, the Agagites, attacked them. And they swooped in at the back of the line of Jews, killing the children and the old ladies and the cripples who were lagging behind. The Amalekites came in to kill them. You might remember the story, and Moses sent Joshua with some of the army, where he went up on the hill to hold up the staff of the Lord in prayer. They wanted to kill the Jews as they escaped from Egypt. And yet Satan's attempts didn't stop there. Satan has always been striving against God's people. And because bound up in the survival of God's people is God's promises to send the Messiah, all of God's purposes for redemption, which must come true. They're all tied up in this. And so Satan is fighting tooth and nail, isn't he, to stop that happening. If Satan can wipe out the Jews here in the book of Esther, that's the end of the Bible. That's as far as your Bible gets. If this didn't happen, if this second law was never passed, and the day comes round when they hope to overpower the Jews and it happens, that's the end of your Bible. And all God's people were killed. And all God's purposes came to nothing. All God's promises turned out to be lies. God has failed. That's the climax of the Book of Esther. Things do stand on that brink of a knife. We don't know as we're reading it through what's going to happen next. But Satan will do nothing, do everything he can to stop the Messiah. We pick up the same sort of story in another battle in the New Testament. After Jesus is born, we find Herod the Great, he called himself. And who did he descend from? He was from Idumea, which were the descendants of the Amalekites and the Agagites. We find another character in the same family line, who when he hears from the Magi of the king of the Jews who's been born, he orders the massacre of all the children, all the boys in Bethlehem. It's part of the same cosmic conflict, isn't it? Satan doing whatever he can to stop God and his purposes. We might look at chapter 9 and see it as being this primitive, barbaric situation that happened so long ago. But it's just part of something that's there in the entire history of the human race. It's echoed out even back in the Garden of Eden. As God says to Satan, that there'll come the seed of the woman who will crush your head and you'll strike his heel. There'll be this battle continually going on between Satan and his seed and those who will follow him. And God and the seed of Eve and Adam. Until there would be that final battle. We see it in so many ways. Part of this cosmic conflict that is going on. And chapter 9 just gives us a flavour of the reality of that. For Jesus said, I will build my church. And not even the gates of hell will prevail against it. You could translate the word gates as teeth. It's a very sort of personified image. And the teeth of hell won't prevail against it. But that gives you a remarkable image, doesn't it? That Jesus is building his church right within the fangs of this serpent. Who's doing whatever he can to chomp down on it and destroy it. And Christ will build his church. Even though Satan's teeth are there. Hell's gates are there, right, wishing to overpower it and destroy it. But Christ will build his church. So we see here in Esther chapter 9 that Christ is building his church. He's fulfilling these promises. He's keeping everything going so that the Christ could be born in years to come and so on. And even here in chapter 9 of the book of Esther, there's even hints of that final battle that would take place too. For though Christ has won the victory, although Christ has defeated Satan and crushed him, though Christ has triumphed over him, even ridiculing him at the cross and through his resurrection, there's still a battle going on. There's still this intense, gritty, grim fighting going on. And we're naive if we think it's something that's just there in the parts of the Old Testament. But it's a battle that will take place right until the very end. Chapter 19 of Revelation and verse 11, I saw heaven opened and behold a white horse. And he who sat on it was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war. Following him were the armies of heaven on white horses. Out of his mouth goes a sharp sword and he'll strike down the nations. He'll rule them with a rod of iron. It's about him throwing Satan and the beast and the false prophet into the lake of fire in that final climactic battle. Here in chapter 9, there were these mentions. In the end, they had rest. They had rest, but it was only a temporary rest that they had. But in the end, there will be a final rest. When that victory is finally complete, and as we read in Corinthians, may the God of peace crush Satan under your feet. And we look forward to that, don't we? When Satan will finally be crushed. When there will be an end of all of this bloodshed and violence. When there will be an end of sin. When there will be an end of all of those evil realities that there are. And we're part of this conflict. This cosmic battle is still taking place today. And Paul picks up the language, yes. We don't fight with weapons of war. We don't fight with swords like they're doing here. Our fight is not against flesh and blood, but it is a fight all the same. And yet the other remarkable thing to remember at this time, of course, as part of that cosmic conflict that's going on, we remember the Prince of Peace who was born. And the Prince of Peace who was born as that baby in Bethlehem, and the angel sang of peace. Peace from God to men. There's this offer of peace. This offer of peace is held out. There's even a hint of that here in Esther. In Esther chapter 8, verse 17, it says, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and holiday. And many of the people of the land became Jews. Just a little snippet. We're not told any more than that. But there were those who perhaps before this had been thinking of this day coming round when they're going to go and kill their neighbours and loot all their stuff because they're Jews. And then through all of these things that happen, through this next law that comes, there were those who sought peace. There were those who became Jews, who converted to Judaism, who feared God instead. And so there is that offer of peace, isn't there? From the King of Kings, from the Prince of Peace. Maybe as we read chapters like this and we see this brutality and bloodshed, and yet we're reminded of our own frailty. We're reminded of our own flesh and blood nature. Maybe sometimes that makes us afraid. Afraid of death and judgment. Afraid of that final climactic end of the world. And where will we be? Will we be safe on that day? Will we face punishment? Will we face destruction? Well, the Prince of Peace offers peace to all who would turn to him. All who would want to flee from the judgment to come. All who want to avoid coming under the judgment of God. Any one of us can turn to Christ. There was that option even for the people here, that they could turn away from this and they could have peace. Well, it'll be for us. We'll be those who do think about the reality of the situation of which we live, the reality of what the future holds, and that end of the world that will happen one day. Are we those who, because of that, through a fear of that, want to flee from that and turn to Christ? For Christ came, he said, not to judge the world the first time, but to save anyone who would turn to him. But he warns us he will come back again in judgment. So which will it be? Will we sit idly by and just hope for the best? One day to fall under the judgment of Christ. Or will we turn to him now? The Prince of Peace, the Saviour, who offers peace and forgiveness for anyone who would turn to him. Let's sing together our last hymn as we close. This one's not in the hymn books, just up here on the screen. Hopefully, O Church, arise and put your armour on. Hear the call of Christ, our Captain. Let's stand and sing.